Okay. We left off last time on Dr. Testament Aleph, and we were we had pretty much finished towards the bottom the discussion of Nidui, of excommunication, and where it's mentioned in the Mishnah, and Rabbi Elazar only found three places, and maybe two other places in the Braisa, but it's not in the Mishnah. And the Gemara concludes by stating, I think we read this last week, that, or I'll read it again anyway. It says, if we go to about 17, 18 lines from the bottom, a couple of lines before the first, you know, set of two dots, the Tanu Rabbanu. So just above that, two lines, three lines. V'tanya, Oso Hayom Heviu Kol Taro Shetiha Rabbi Eliezer Srafim L'chanam. That day they brought all the taros that were all the food that had been done using this Tanu that Rabbi Eliezer claimed was Tahor, and the Chachamim believed was Tameh, and they took all his taros, presumably Trumos, there was no Beis HaMikdash, and they or Chulin, and they burned it. They burned it in front of him. And then Ula B'Sof, in the end, after they'd done that, Berchu, they excommunicated him. Right? So the Gemara says, Afilu Hochi Nidi B'Mastis and Lotznan. It doesn't say in the Mishnah, in Kalim, when they talk about Tanur or Shalachnai, when the Mishnah says, Zehu Tanur Shalachnai, he doesn't say that they excommunicated him. That's in a Braisa. The story's elsewhere. So in the end, the Gemara says, Ala B'Chafta Al Matomo, Seicha Mashkakasla, where do you get 24? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yishub and Levi, Midame Milsa Lamilsa, Rabbi Lazar Lamidame Milsa Lamilsa. So apparently, again, what exactly these cases are, Rashi just says that any time Rabbi Yoshua saw a place in the Mishnah where a Yachid was Cholek on the Rabbin, Machlokes Gedola, I don't know, or a Chacham who spoke harshly of someone who was superior to him, again, I don't, so Rabbi Yishub and Levi assumes neither should apply in these places. Even though it doesn't say in the Mishnah that the person should have been excommunicated, was excommunicated, was right to be excommunicated, nonetheless, that's how he came up with 24. Okay. We spoke a lot about Tanur Shalachnai and the whole story last week. I wanted to just mention one detail because it's a powerful point. Rav Nissen Gon, in the commentary printed on the side of the Gemara, cites the Yerushalmi, which is, the Yerushalmi says, discusses why was the Halacha not like Rabbi Eliezer, if he had such heavenly support. And the Rishonim says, because we have a principle of Achrei Rabin Lahatas. In Halacha, we always follow a majority. So the question then is, the Rishonim asks, didn't Rabbi Eliezer know that too? Didn't he know that that was the rule? So the Rishonim says, yes, he did. But the reason why he fought and the reason why he didn't see and he was so angry was because they burned his stuff in front of him. And he perceived that it was a personal insult. They could have burned it not in his presence. They could have burned elsewhere. They could have declared it on the end of the discussion. But it was almost a personal affront what they did to Rabbi Eliezer. And in some ways, that fits with what the Gemara in Bava Metzia, in the Bavli, when it talks about it. What, I can ask the question, why is the story of Tanur Shalachnai in Bava Metzia Dachmikhev? Of all places, I mean, you have 2,700 something blood in Chas. What was it that prompted to be brought there? And the answer is that the Mishnah there is about Ona'as Tavarim. It's about the Perek mostly talks about Ona'as Mamon, when you cheat somebody in business. And then it finally says that just as there's Ona'a B'Mamon, there's also Ona'a B'Dvarim, to inflict emotional pain upon someone else. And so it's in that context that the Gemara quotes the story. Because remember the end, I think I mentioned last week, is that his sister was married to Rabbi Gamaliel, and she was terrified that Rabbi Lesher was going to, I'm sorry, he was mad for Gamaliel's sister, and she was terrified he was going to say Tachanun, you know, and requesting Evoshu, Ma'od Kalvayashu Evoshu Raga, that God was going to punish him, and that's what happened in the end. So the Gemara really presents it as a question of Ona'as Tavarim. And while the Bava, I don't think, fills that in, the Yerushalmi says, they were sorry as Taros and Lafana. Okay, you burn the stuff. You don't have to do it in his face. And he perceived that it wasn't a shame shemayim. He perceived that it was a personal insult. Okay. All right, so now back to the more mundane Kriya Shema. And we are at the two dots. And the Mishnah says, Nosei Hamita V'Chilufehen. So the Mishnah had said, and the way Tosfos explains, most Rishonim explained, the defense upon the Girsa, those who are carrying the bed, what we would call the coffin, said it was a bed, and those who are going to swap into them, so the basically the rule is if you're needed for carrying, then you pata from Kriya Shema, etc. If you're not needed, so then you go so say Kriya Shema. So the Gemara said,
that's why they're carrying this thing.
They
didn't have the concept of putting it in a cart or
no. I mean, I would say they did know the wheel, but no, I mean, the truth is, they, typically speaking, where they buried, they took the mace, would have been from his house. I don't think there was such a thing as a funeral home. They took the mace from the house when it was ready, and they did have, strangely as it sounds to us, it would appear at least once upon a time for women, some of the time, and for men, eventually they stopped doing it for women, and we don't do it for men, obviously. They had a viewing. I know that sounds very Christian, but they had the mace on the mitzvah. Eventually they covered the mace, even though the mace was on the mitzvah. They stopped doing viewings or under certain circumstances. Again, it's totally foreign to us. The idea that you have a viewing, but nonetheless, we think of that as a Christian concept, that one they stole from us. We have since abandoned it. And then they would carry the mace to the cemetery. The cemetery wasn't out on Long Island. Then the cemetery was outside the city. So it probably wasn't very far. There are a lot of Mishnayot. And other sources in Chazal that talk about these questions of when they sometimes bury outside the city. If they didn't bury in a clearly marked cemetery, what do you assume about mounds outside the city of Kwanon? Do we assume that there's a mace buried there? But you can see that that's what they used to do. So it's not that mace were never transported. They were sometimes transported to Eretz Yisrael. And in that case, I think it's clear that the Gemara uses the term Arab, Arono Balakan. But as a general rule, I think when they bury locally, I don't think you had a wrong.
You can see it in the, if you go to Poland, they buried in, the graves are in the city.
Right. Look, it was.
The cemeteries were in the city.
I don't know when this shift in America, but you can go to many places in Bergen County, you'll see churches, and right next to the churches on cemeteries. Right? Right. So you don't, there was no transportation, over long distances. And in the Gemara, as best as I can tell, the only transportation that we read about is mason being carried from Babel Peretz Yisrael. There was one story, I forget who the Amora is, it's probably Moed Katan, where I guess there was some Amora in Babel that the Amora in Eretz Yisrael was terrified, and they said that he's come here, and the guy was like really terrified and worried. They said, no, it's Arona all the time. And it was his coffin all the time. So. Okay.
Rabbi, the Gemara then the Ksubos talks about somebody's saying that when you're alive, you're in Babel, and now when you're dead, you're coming to Israel. Why are you bringing your impurities to Israel?
They didn't like that. Some didn't like that idea. We apparently ignore that today. A lot of people ignore that today. Okay. Right. It's close to being buried in Eretz Yisrael, but the bigger is close to live in Eretz Yisrael. Okay.
When did they use sarcophagus burials?
When did they use sarcophagus? I don't know how common that was. When you say a sarcophagus, you mean like a stone coffin.
A stone coffin.
Yeah. I don't know how commonly that was used very commonly amongst, it exists, but I don't know to what extent that was used for royalty or something like that. What you have, I think, more commonly is they have ossuaries, which were like small boxes. Because what they would do is they would bury, you read the Mishnah in Baba Basra, and they would bury people in crypts. They would put the body there. They would sort of close a rock in front of it. I'll talk about that later today. Hopefully we can talk about what's the goal of a dofek on the next Amud. And then they would allow the body to decompose. And then they would wait. And then when they would liquid atzamas, they gather the bones. And they put in this small thing in an ossuary. But a sarcophagus, I don't know how. I don't want to say no because I don't know enough of that. But I don't think that was a common.
I was actually thinking of an ossuary then because I know that. That right. is very common in a lot of places.
Yeah, so that was one practice. That the kura and the karka, the way we do it today, and it was already being done in Ashkenaz, sure in Ashkenaz, the medieval period. That I don't think that was the common. Again, I in Eretz Yisrael, I certainly don't think that was the standard form of burial. I don't know what the story was in Babel. Okay, but yes, that was very common in the rabbinic period. Okay, so now the Gemara says, the comment Mishnah said, no semit nefsidufein, if you're needed for the burial of your potter, because you're osik the mitzvah, you're not. Tana rabbanon ein motzien es hameis samach l'kriyashma. You're not allowed to begin the process of taking the mace out, samach l'kriyashma. The question is, what does samach l'kriyashma mean? So there are, I think Talmidei Ben Yonah, quotes, it's not clear to me why the two interpretations are so different. I think I know the differences, but the first interpretation he quotes is sort of a more standard thing. Samoch or Kriyashma. Samoch in general means hour before. That's what we say. You're not allowed to eat. You're not supposed to do malacha on Erev Shabbos or Erev Yom Tov. Not lametes malachas, but your own personal work. You're not supposed to do Erev Shabbos Yom Tov. Shamach lamincha, beginning with a half an hour before mincha, whichever mincha gedol mincha time it is. So shamach lekriyas shema is very early. Now, it's starting very early morning. One is not supposed to take the mace out. Once you're within 30 minutes of the zman kriyas shema. And I believe the difference of opinion that the Rabbi Yonah quotes is either you have to wait until after the entire zman kriyas shema is passed, or you have to wait long enough into the period, let's say an hour, where most people reasonably could read kriyas shema. And then you can, even though it's still zman kriyas shema, people who are going to do the mitzvah have had the time to say kriyas shema, and then you can carry the mace out. So that was samach with kriyas shema, either means in the time period right before, or it means samach to the zman where kriyas shema began, because you have to give people time afterwards to say the kriyas shema, and then you can proceed with the funeral. And then the Gemara
ends. Feeding obligation to bury the mace quickly possible.
So I think the assumption is that there's an interesting machlokas in the Rishonim, or discussion in the Rishonim, does this apply to Kriya Shema Shel Arvis? And some say, yeah, it's the exact same thing. And some say no, because the concern by Kriya Shema Shel Arvis at night is that you're trying to bury the body because you don't want to violate Lo Salim Nidlas Dalait, leaving the mace overnight. But once it reaches the morning, whatever has been, so waiting the extra hour is not considered, the concern, when we have two mitzvahs, and one of them is a mitzvah veris, and one is a shah veris, and the time is passing, and you can lose the opportunity. The other one's not. So we generally do the one that the shah, we try to do the one that shah is overis first, and then we go back and do the other one. So now the Gemara continues, and it says, Inni, is that true? V'mischilu ein mafsikin. But if you began to be mochi the mace, which might mean maybe you shouldn't have, or maybe you started long before time, and when Zman Kriya Shema comes, you don't interrupt. And you finish burying, once you've started the mitzvah, you finish the mitzvah. And if finishing the mitzvah, it would appear, it's not explicit. What would happen if you're not going to have enough time to finish Kriya Shema? So it might be that that those people who are needed for burying the mace, once they start the mitzvah, are going to miss the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. That's the way it is. That's, I think, the simple understanding of the Gemara. So now the Gemara says, Ini, is that really true that you're not allowed to be motzi esameh samach l'kriya shema? Baho Rabbi Yosef afkuhu samach l'kriya shema. Rabbi Yosef, when he died, so they took him out samach l'kriya shema. So the Gemara answer is a very interesting answer. Adam chashuv shana. It's a very interesting answer because this phrase normally never means what it means here. Adam chashuv shana here means that a person who's a talmid chacham, a very important person, the kavod for him is, even though it's not a kriya shema, you're running into it, you do it anyway, because that's kavod hames, right? And there may be many things that were mevatel because of kavod hames, other things that were mevatel. So the Gemara is going to have a principle we're going to be dealing with starting this week, but we'll take a little break. The whole sugya of kavod habrios, kavod habrios is docha, and generally speaking, kavod habrios, while I'm going to make an overstatement, this isn't really true. Kavod HaBrios is docha dinam derabbanon, and Kavod HaBrios may be docha some things that are deraisa as long as your violation is passive. So here, the kavod of an adam chashuv might push aside the mitzvah kriya shema. Now, what's odd about the expression adam chashuv shani is that, I don't want to say, I didn't look at every place. If you look in the Mesoras HaShas here, if you look in, at least in my edition, some of them it's a star and it's just all listed on the side. But if you, in mine, it's in the Oz V'Hadar edition, it is printed on the top, and letter chaf, and you can see there look to be somewhere between, I don't know, perhaps neighbor 15 times in Shas, the expression Adam Chashuv Shani appears. Well, what Adam Chashuv Shani usually means, I didn't check them all, but I know what it normally means is actually quite the opposite. Here, the suggestion is that because Rav Yosef was an Adam Chashuv, you would take greater liberties with halacha. Normally what Adam Chashuv Shani means throughout Shas is that even though some things may actually technically be mutter, if a person is an Adam Chashuv, a Talmud Chacham, he or she is not allowed to do certain things because of appearances, even though it's technically permitted. In other words, Adam Chashuv is held to a higher standard. I know probably, I don't know if we'll speak this, the Chagas Nechas coming up again in the fall. I think we have two coming this year they'll be closer together because we missed one because of COVID. So this is the Tashlumen. So I remember the last time, and I'm sure if Rav Schechter speaks again, he's going to say the same thing to the Mishmachim. He says, you're going to have to remember that you're a rabbi So you're held to a different standard. You can't sit and learn Darikah Zeras Hashem because you're a bad example to the Baal Batim in doing so. And while you may learn, they're going to wind up talking. And so his point that he makes is that you have to understand, Adam, I don't know if you use this question, Adam Chashav Shani, that when you are a leader of one kind or another, you have to be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard. You don't get to take liberties because you happen to be in a position of leadership. So here, that's not what it means. Here, Rav Yosef wasn't doing anything. He was dead. Well, here the Gemara is saying, because of Kavod, Adam Chashav Shani, therefore you're allowed to be Motziim, even though Tigi is not Kriyashma. What is really interesting about this is that if you look in the Rif here, and then you look in the Rosh, they don't quote the second part. They just say, Emotziim Esamei Samach Kriyashma, period. And if he's Chigo Emotziim, that's a quote. They don't quote anything, Vim Adam Chashavu, then it's permitted. Now, the Tor in Hilchos Kriyashma quotes this Gemara, and then he quotes the Adam Chashav piece, and he says, my father left it out, and I don't know why. Now, the truth is, I this is not really an answer, but I would argue the Rush left it out because the Riff left it out, which simply pushes the question one step back, which is, why did the Riff leave this out? And I'm pretty sure, although I didn't check, I'd imagine the Rama might have left it out too. I assume that because there's no letter on Adam Chashav Shani here, but it could be, maybe the Rambam does quote, I don't know. But the question is, why did the Rush and the Riff leave it out? So the Beis Yosef has a comment, which I don't really fully understand. He says perhaps they thought that that really wasn't the reason what happened with Rabbi Yosef. I think what happened with Rabbi Yosef is that the people just made a mistake. They didn't do it properly. But once you start, you're not master. But it doesn't really explain why did the Gemara actually give this parrot? And on what basis are you actually rejecting it? I thought that one could have suggested, and maybe I saw, I couldn't find this yesterday when I was looking, but when I prepared this Gemara a couple of weeks ago, I thought I saw somebody who argued, and I don't know if it was in this context. We have a concept, is that the halacha has a concept of a Talmud Chacham. I know that sounds strange. But a Talmud Chacham, in some context, is awarded certain prerogatives, whatever they are. And you will find already some of the Rishonim say that we don't have such a thing, that we don't have any Talmud Chacham who's on the level to be claimed that they have that particular privilege of Talmud Chacham. You had a concept, for example, where you hold up the shuk for the Talmud Chacham. Like if people coming to sell, and the Talmud Chacham comes to sell a stuff, you have to close the other, temporarily put a hold on all the selling until he sells his wares. He could go on. The Rambam, I think, says that's what they would do for any other mechasher. So if you, that's what, again, today we would never do that. Today it's a free-for-all. But if the practice in a community, in a world, was that when an other mechasher came, you were, oh, Jesus HaShuk, you held the Shuk back, you have to do that for Talmud Chacham as well. So that kind of thing we would say, even if you were in such a place, we might say today there's no Talmud Chacham anymore. There are other contexts in which Rishonim say it. So one could argue that's the very same logic here. Maybe why the Rif didn't quote it and the Rush didn't quote it is to say, hell, that this category, this kind of a Talmud Chacham, for whom you would be Mavatel Kriyashma, doesn't exist anymore. We don't have such Talmud Chacham, and therefore they don't quote it. Not totally satisfactory. They could have quoted it and said, but anyway, for whatever reason, they left it out. So, okay. So now,
if you believe the argument, though, people will say, this is the Talmud Chacham, we'll do it. And if you leave it out, it's over.
Well, but that would have always been a reason. That always would have been a reason, even with not high Gemara. Right? And yes, well, one gets the sense from the Gemara that everybody understood. There was a little bit of a known pecking order, but, you know. But that is 100% correct. You know, with a lot of things that we do, because each person is going to say. So we saw earlier in the Masechta what was it? Where the Rush said, maybe it wasn't in Brachos. I thought it was. It might be in Megillah by the Torah. That originally you're supposed to read your own Aliyah. However, they were, at some point, it's not in the Gemara, they instituted the practice of having a chazan. Chazan means about Kriya, Bal Kore, who would read because there are people who didn't know. And the Rush writes that it's clear from the Rush's comments, this is not just, this is not about not embarrassing someone. Compared it to Mikra Bikurim. The Rush said, no, it's because you can't let individuals do this because each guy is going to think, you know, I know how to lane, and you wind up with such a machloka. So the proper practice is only when you have a Balkari in the context in which one person reads the entire thing, that person reads the entire thing. Because otherwise, you know, I've had occasions where someone will turn to me and get on Leah, say, do you want to read your own? And I say, no, it's not proper for me to write your own. Because you can just imagine, if I read my own, the next guy says, well, you can read your own, so and so on. So we're all happier, well, happier this time. Okay. So now,
just because it's uncomfortable with me.
Yeah, that's right.
What's that?
When the Olam is correct.
You guys probably want to read.
I'm quiet. I'm very quiet. You know, I violated yesterday. I told the Gabbai, our shul is, you know, we are slowly returning to normalcy. We could do everything normally, but they're fearful of anxiety, people. You know, even anybody who's there. So the Gabbai, so they finally took the divider away, but they left it on the bima. So if somebody wants it, they can use it. Okay. And now the Gabbai, we're still supposed to stand next to the bima. But yesterday, you know, whatever they took the partition out, I said to my Gabbai Rishon, I can't correct the way I want to correct, which is standing quietly.
Right.
So, because that's the policy in our school. Nobody's supposed to correct except the Gabbai Sheni. So I like to be able to do it very quietly, but when I'm 4 feet away, I can't do that anymore. So if it's already okay, and somebody else's anxiety, let them manage their anxiety. So if the Baal Kriya once is happy to have me up there, that's what I'm going to do. So I go quiet.
Sir, Rabbi Weider?
Yes.
If you now daven in a shul without a mechitza, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because that's a bit of a surprise to me.
Marshall, I assume you're just having fun with that. There's no partition between the Ola and the reader, not a mechitza between the men and the women section. So.
Oh, sorry. I guess I must have missed it because I already tweeted it out, but I'll try to take it back. Okay, no worries.
Okay, that's fine.
I hope you have good counsel.
You know, I think I'm going to have to just mute him.
We all thought about that.
You thought. He goes to Mayapak and you wouldn't have to hear him from there. Okay. So now the Gemara picks up on the next piece. So the Gemara now, this, Bryce is now going to talk about the following scenario when they stopped and either the Aron was there or the Aron wasn't there. And the base of the Avelim are sitting there and everybody in the audience, you know, is there for the Hesbedim. So the Bryce says the following. Tan Rabbanon, Ha'oskim Behesbedim. The people who are there for the eulogy, in other words, if the mace is there, which means presumably, firstly, you don't want to do things there, any kinds of mitzvahs you don't want to do right there, and presumably these people are giving his faith. They might be going on, but they're there. So what people are supposed to do is mishnatim echad echad dekor. Each one, you know, you see him, you know, the sastan gets up and you know, oh my God, this is going to be a long one. So 2-3 sentences in, you kind of slip out. You need to, like, a bathroom break. So you say your Kriya Shema then. That's if the mace is there, and which means presumably there's an element of hesped going on. Or not. I mean, and the truth is, I think it has to be the hesped going on, because otherwise they could all just, why nishmatim echad echad? They should all step out and do it. But that would be really not nice if somebody's giving a hesped, even if deserved. And then Eina Mace Mutal, if the mace isn't there, so it means they're not giving the Hesbedim yet. That's what I presume. Hin Yoshu Nikorin, they all sit and read Kriyashma, meaning everybody can read themselves together, or at the same time. But who Yoshe Vidomim, and he remains silent. The Avel cannot recite Kriyashma, he can't do mitzvah. Heim Omdum Mitzvah, then they get up and daven. Vuhu Omeidu Matzika Lavasadin. So while they're davening, it may not look so good that they're davening through Rosh Hashanah. What is he? He doesn't do anything. So he does his own Tfila, if you want to call it. He does Tzidukah Din. The Omer, Ribon Ha'olamim, Harbe Chatasi Lefanecha, Velo Nikrata Mimeni, Achan Mini Allah. He says, Ribon Shalolam, I have sinned so much before you, and you haven't even exacted even 1/1000th of the punishment I deserve. Yihi Ratzon Lefanecha, Hashem Elokeinu, may it be your will, Shetigdar Pirtso Seinu, you should fence in our broken, our breaches, Upirtsos Ka'am Cha Yisrael Barachan. And all the breaches of your people, the Jewish nation, with mercy. That's what he engages in Tzedakah Din. Tzedakah Din basically means that you are just God, I haven't even gotten what I fully deserve, and may you make things better for us. So Amar Abaye says, Lo mi bai lele inish lamei marhachi. The person shouldn't say that. You shouldn't speak. And the part that he's focusing on is on the lo nifrata mimeni echad mini alas. The am Rabbi Yishuman ben Lachish, v'chein tanem ishmed Rabbi Yosei, le'olam al yiftach adam piv l'satan. You know, which we would translate, don't give him any ideas. Right? So this is obviously some, I don't know if this is a psychological statement. In other words, what, God and the Satan don't know? Like it's only, you know, what they say, Lamashal Lahavdil, when a person is struggling, you know, with mental health issues, and people are sometimes afraid to ask them are suicidal. So every therapist I've ever talked about this says, of course you ask them. You're not gonna plant the idea in their head. So here, I'm not saying the Gemara is not commenting on that situation, but the Gemara is saying that don't plant ideas in the head of the suffer. Don't plant ideas in the head of the suffer. Right. As if the Ribono Shlom doesn't know already. Nonetheless, I suspect it's about us. It's about our own psychological framework, not about whether the Satan is an idiot. It's clear the Satan has a lot of time on his hands, and he's figured out lots of ways to cause trouble. He doesn't need our help. However, as a hint to this, the Gemara quotes the following. The Pasuk in Yeshayah. Shenemar, and I'll quote the full thing. The Navi is speaking, or he's speaking with the voice of, either as the voice of the people, or he's speaking as what the people would say. Lulei Hashem Tzvakos, Hosir Lanu Sarid Kima. If God had only, you know, if not for the fact that God left over for us a small remnant, a Sarid Kimat, Kisdom Hayinu La'amara Damina. We would have been like Sodom and Amora, which were totally desolate. And then the next verse, the prophet says, My Ahada Lehu Navi, what does the Navi respond? Shemu Dvar Hashem Kitsine Sodom. Ha'azinu Torah Elokeinu Am Amora. Right, so the Navi has got, yeah, that's a good place to label them. Right, these are the people, obviously the two are not the same. They're referring to Sodom and Amora being desolate, and the Navi is referring to the moral character of Sodom and Amora. But don't give the Navi, don't give him any ideas as to what he might call you. Okay. All right. So again, I think that this is probably more about the self-psychology than it is about planting any ideas in the head of the subject. Okay. Now the Gemara says, quote, if you look back at the Mishnah says that Kavuras Tameis Chazurus, they buried the mace, and now they return, and now they're going to go to the Shura, right, where they're going to be Menachem in the auto. Im Yecholim Mahaskil V'Ligmar Achele Yagir, the Shura Yastidim, Im Lav Lo Yastidim. If they're able to start and finish before they reach the Shura, where presumably they would have to stop, well, that may not be the case. So then, they should. If not, they shouldn't. So the Gemara says the following, quoting the Mishnah, "In Yecholam Lahaska the Ligmar implies es kula. If they could start and finish, well, the Mishnah says that they could start and finish what? So the assumption is finish all of it. You could start Kriyashma and finish all the Kriyashma. So in Yecholam Lahaska the Ligmar, and the Gemara says es kula in Aval Perakachot or Pasach Echadlot. But if you could only complete the first parsha, even the first pasuk, then you don't start. The reminu kavura sameis v'chazur michol nahaska v'ligmar afilu perakachar pasuk echad. There's a brayse that says that if they bury the mace and they have now returned, and you only have enough time to start, finish the first parak, the first pasuk, the Gemara says you should. The brayse says you should do that. So how does that doesn't fit with the Mishnah? You're puzzled, man.
Well, it's not exactly possible, right? The other way is you can do it later, right? You're already finished, and this is what you can do. So maybe...
Well, one of them, but the Bryce and the Mishnah are identical cases. They both cover us and ace the puzzle. Whatever the scenario is, whether you do or don't have time later, you know, whether the consideration here is you're going to miss Kriya Shema, or the consideration is you want to, you know, don't push it off any further. So either way, they're the same scenario, the Mishnah Bryce, cover us and ace the puzzle. And yet the Mishnah implies in Yecholam Lahaskel of the Ligmar, and the Gemara makes an inference, which is about to reject, Ligmar Eskula, all of it, then you should start. So the Gemara says, no, the Mishnah means, in Yecholam Lahaskel of the Ligmar, Afilu Perakachar, Afilu Pasakachar, Ad Shele Yagir the Shura, until they reach the Shura, Yasid the Lablo Yasid. So I have a question and I have a comment. The question, which I do know the answer to, sort of, but I don't know the answer to, I'm surprised the Gemara doesn't ask. It's a very odd formulation. In Yechol Lahaskel, Afilu Perekechad, Afilu Pasekechad. In other words, why say Perekechad? The bottom line is if you have enough time to say the entire first parsha, then you certainly have enough time to say Kriya, just the Pasek of Kriya Shema, the first Pasek. So why tell us in Yechol Lahaskel, Afilu Perekechad, Afilu Pasekechad? Now, the truth is, this might be the same phenomenon where the Mishnah and the Gemara often ask, they don't ask here. The Mishnah in Shabbos says that on Shabbos you can be mafana, you can move out. If you need to move out, you need space, and you want to move out curtains of stuff of heaven, you can move out even dalit or hamish, you know, kupos of heaven. So the Gemara asks, if you can move out four, Why, if you have five, why do you have to tell us you can move out four? So you know what the Pshat, I know what Pshat and Mishnah is. Pshat and Mishnah, it works there, I don't know if it works here, or maybe it does work here too. Four or five is just, that's not la dachta. Now if the Gemara, when it asks the question, it's going to be, no, five is an absolute limit, so why do you even tell us four? And the Gemara gives an answer. It says, four out of a small otzar, meaning if there are only five there in the first place, you can do four because you can't clean out the entire room. Whatever the reasons why, you can't clear the room entirely. And if you have larger, more than five boxes, then you can move out a maximum of five. Even if there are 100 boxes.
Four or five sounds more like about four or five.
Or we would say four or five means many. As many as you need.
Several.
Right. That's what one would have assumed. So, but that, sometimes they don't read that one. I would assume the same thing here. This is like four or five, but it's like saying five or four. Now, that would sound strange to us. We wouldn't say five or four, but that's what it's saying. If you can finish the first paragraph, or even the first pasuk, that's probably what the pshat. And nobody, as far as I've seen comments on this, the assumption is pasuk rishon is enough. But this is the question that actually appears to me is a machlokas in the Rishonim. Once you start and you have enough time to finish the first pasuk or the first paragraph, do you have to stop and interrupt once you started? And some Rishonim say, no, you don't. Others, now, that seems to be difficult because, now, on the one hand, you're saying you started the mitzvah. On the other hand, then if you can't finish the mitzvah and you're going to run into the shura time, then why would we allow you to or suggest that you start if you can't actually finish what you really need to do in one shot? So there are those who would say, no, you just read the first pasuk, first paragraph, because if you remember, there are many opinions in the Rishonim and in the Achronim that the first pasuk is the only part that's the reisa. So the answer is, say, if you have enough time, say the first part, pasuk, or the first paragraph, but those are sort of the two main opinions. What's the reisa? First pasuk, maybe first paragraph, sometimes stuff in between, maybe some point in between. So the simpler reading of the reisa, I think, is that if you have enough time to finish a meaningful unit where you accomplish something, then you should do that. Otherwise, just wait till afterwards. Okay. And then a line that always amuses me, but it shows you, of course, teaches you that human nature never ever changes. The Gemara on the top of your test on the day says the following: Ha'omdim b'shura, Tana Rabbanan, Shura haroa penima, petura, v'she'ena roa penima, chayeve. If you have a row that's on the inside that sees the avelim directly, so they are potur from saying Kriya Shema, but kind of inappropriate. The outer ones, ain't a row of Panima, if you're not, you don't have a front row seat, so then you have to say Kriya Shema. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Havoyim Mechamas Ha'Avel, Beturim, Mechamas Atzmon Chayavim. Those who are coming because of the Avel, so they are Potter. Those who are there because of themselves, as Rashi says, not because of Kavod, they didn't come to Menachem. They want to see what's going on. Right? That happens all the time. Right? It's one of the most maddening things for those of us who spend a lot of our lives driving. Well, it's called rubbernecking. My feeling is the person's dead or they're not dead. If you're not stopping to help, just keep going. So in this case, these are the people who came to entertain themselves. They want to see. I guess back then they didn't have, you know, Netflix and Twitter and Facebook. So life could get boring at times. So let's go to a funeral. Huh? Let's see what they're saying. Okay. I don't know. But that's what Rashi says. They came to see, you know, what's going on. Okay. All right. Now we get to what might be a somewhat famous Gemara, one that you hope you never have to personally experience. Amar Rav Yehuda Amara, Hamote Kilayim Bebigdo, Poshtan Afilu Bashuk. If a person discovers all of a sudden,
My thing says the chutney's free, so I'm okay.
Okay? But all of a sudden, someone discovers chutneys in their garment. They have to immediately take the garment off. It doesn't matter where they are.
What's the connection here with the chutneys?
Good question. Let's hold off on that. Let's just wait a moment for that. At first glance, I think you'll see the connection more directly, or what's in the sugya. You could have seen a lot of this has to do with Kavod HaBeis, which is a form of Kavod HaBrios. Oh, wait. Yes. So you got to let me read the next line. So it's still not going to make it 100% clear, but you'll see at least where it's going. My time, why is it? Why can't you wait till you get home? Now, the truth is, when you're wearing Kalayim, you are violating Avera every moment that you're wearing. You're violating every moment that you're wearing. The Gemara says, why can't you wait? because in chachma in truna in etzel leneged Hashem, right? We would say, you know, someone, you say to someone, don't give me your chachma. The Rosh Hashanah doesn't need our chachma. When there's a chil Hashem, when there's a violation of God's word, so there's no we don't engage in, you know, pilpul and you know, someone become chacham, okay, he's b'chal shem shemai, but you can't say it, he's become chacham. No, it's not true. In chacham avin tzur neitzel neged Hashem kol makom sheishchil Hashem in cholkin kavod rab. There's no kavod rab and there's no kavod abrius. Right, when there's chil Hashem, we don't say, oh, now we're worried about kavod abrius. Now meisvei. Yeah, before we go there, so the Gemara is now going to launch into a discussion, basically, of Kavod HaBrios. In other words, you're saying that when a person discovers that Kalayim and Ebeged, they have to suffer the embarrassment of stripping off there in public, because in Chachma Vein, Tzuna Vein, Eitz, Lenegan Hashem. So now the Gemara is going to launch into a discussion of Kavod HaBrios, but first I want to talk about this particular issue, because it actually has some possible ramifications halacha, but not where you would have expected it. I don't assume too many of us find kilayim in our beged. But point number one is a really interesting, a larger question. Let's say I know that your garment contains shatnez, but you don't. Am I supposed to tell you? Or should I wait till you go back to your apartment and call yourself and drop the email? Right. And if you find out, you're obligated to strip off. So the rush here, quote to Yerushalmi, Yerushalmi says, Rav Ami hava Yosef umasne. Rav Ami was sitting and giving shir. Amar chad lechavre, one of the guys in the shir, said to the other one, at lovash kilayim. You're wearing kilayim. And this sounds like, you know, a frat boy prank or something like that, right? You know, grand kilayim. So, Amar le Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Ami said to the one who had opened up his mouth, Shlach manech ahavle. Strip off your garment now and give it to him. We'll take off the shot and say, and then you give him your shirt. Now, the implication of the Yerushalmi is that you're not supposed to tell someone. In other words, if they don't know, better that they be shogeg, and you're not obligated, you're not supposed to put them in a position to humiliate themselves. You know, you should say, do me a favor, give me a call when you get home. That's something I want to talk to you about. He gets home and says, okay, now, you're wearing kilayim, so take it off. Now, it's not a problem.
Is that only worth the shot?
Well, it depends. I'll answer the question in two ways. The first thing is the mitzvah of hocheach tochiach, generally speaking, of rebuking someone. The Chazal stated explicitly, it's a very odd pasuk. In terms of odd, there are multiple possible meanings. Hocheach, lo sisnas hocheach abohavecha. Hocheach tochiach asamisnecha. The simple pshat might be, don't harbor what you saw him do wrong in your heart. Tell him, rebuke him. Velo sisa alavche. Now, the simple reason is, so thereby, So you won't violate chet, you won't violate hating him in your heart. Instead, you'll get it off your chest. Now, another possible reading, shot reading, is velosisa alav chet, is that if you don't rebuke him, he continues to sin, and you bear some responsibility because you should have protested. Once you protest and you said your thing, you don't bear any responsibility. But Chazal, now these may all be true, but Chazal have a very interesting interpretation. They say that when you rebuke someone, you're not allowed to do so in public because you're embarrassing the person. Do it in private, because even though nonetheless, if you rebuke him publicly, then you will be punished. And Chazal, I think, states that that's why Yerovam ben Nevat, who became the first king, who broke away the kingdom, on the one hand, he was rewarded because he stood up to Shlomo HaMelech, who was closing in all the breaches so he could collect more taxes to pay for his building projects, and it discouraged people from being all over the Rekha. But Chazal say Yerovam ben Nevat rebuked Shlomo publicly, and that he shouldn't have thought. So that's why ultimately he was managed. He was punished, even though he did manage to take a kingdom. So there's no question. In general, there is a preference for rebuke if somebody's doing something wrong. But the question maybe you're really asking is, what if they're doing it wrong right now, right here? In other words, if someone is a variant, someone does violate a particular Malach and Shabbos they don't know about. They do it. You've seen them do it 5 times. So, and they just did it. So, but you could wait till they're in private to tell them, because they may not do it another time. Your question, I guess, is if, in fact, they're continue to do it publicly, does this apply? So this is what I don't know. But I do think it's important to talk about Kavod HaBrios. We're going to talk about it probably a lot today and in a few weeks from now. Kavod HaBriyos is a very beautiful and important concept, but in the world of halacha, it's a very limited utility. Rav Lichtenstein once acknowledged, a little bit bemoaned this, that when Poskim write, very rarely do they ever explicitly invoke Kavod HaBriyos as a tool, even though Kavod HaBriyos might be the motivating factor for trying to pass the halacha in certain ways. But I actually believe, I'm not sure I agree with that formulation, and let me explain. Kavod HaBriyos is a halachic precept, and the Gemara is about to say that Kavod HaBriyos, Godo Kavod HaBriyos, Shedoche Lo Saseh Shebetorah. It pushes aside a lot. The Gemara is going to say it doesn't. It doesn't mean, kind of, you know, if your host serves you non-kosher meat, you don't want to embarrass them to eat it. It doesn't mean that. That's not how the Gemara takes it. And in fact, if you look throughout Shas, Kavod HaBriyos is a very narrow concept in terms of its halachic usage. It really, as best as I can tell, is in reality employed only in two contexts of Kavod HaBriyos. One is a person being unclothed in public, and the other is a person being able to clean themselves after going to the bathroom. In Hilchos Shabbos, it's one of the clear-cut cases of Kavod HaBriyos. The Gemara will say Kavod HaBriyos overrides rabbinic prohibition. The question is, what is Kavod HaBriyos? Is that uninsulted? That's not Kavod HaBriyos. The Gemara in Shabbos has a number of examples, and this is used in a number of other contexts in Hilchos Shabbos. If a person is going to the bathroom, they need to clean themselves afterwards. So we will allow various kinds of violations for Rabbanon. In other words, if there was no cut toilet paper, so it is permissible to cut the toilet paper in a way that doesn't violate a biblical prohibition. And you're allowed to move muksa for such a thing. Today, it's not relevant to us, but in the Gemara, they used to use rocks to clean themselves. They used to use pebbles, tzoros. So let's say you didn't prepare before Shabbos. Like you didn't tear your toilet paper, you didn't prepare your rocks. Right? So the halacha is, even though you didn't prepare the rocks, as long as it doesn't entail real malacha in taking the rocks from the ground, you're allowed to do so. Because gavol kavod HaBriyos shedocha lo saseh shebetorah. The lo saseh, the Gemara will say, is the prohibition of lo sasor, which is the source for all rabbinic prohibitions. So that's one. So really, the only two cases where you really find kavod HaBriyos as I'll call it a halachic battering ram to override other technical prohibitions, is really in these two contexts. Because the Rishonim, the Gemara doesn't state it explicitly here, although it very strongly implies it, and many Rishonim say it, that when it comes to Kilayim, the only time you have to strip off Kilayim Bashuk is if it's Kilayim Doraisa. But there are categories of clothing based upon the way the linen and the wool is put together. That's only considered Kilayim Derabanan. So there, you can wait till you go into a private setting. So those are really the only two places I'll talk about. I'll take your question, but there's one other context I want to talk about. Yeah.
Right. You're speaking about kavod in the sense of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
The word means honor, right? Do we have another word for dignity? Or
I think Kavod HaBriyos is the... Yeah. So where is a very interesting area where this discussion comes up, and with the same or perhaps a different conclusion, is the following. You have a Kohen who's sleeping in the house. So today, I think most people tend to sleep clothed to one degree or another. It's pretty clear in the time of, I don't know how long ago, but in Chazal's time, it was pretty standard that you had no clothing on when you slept under a cup or under a sheet. So you have a Kohen in the house and someone dies. Kohen's got to leave the house. Yeah, so once the Kohen is obligated to, at least the assumption is, to leave immediately. It's just like if a person is in the Azara and they become tummy. Right? Let's say a lizard tries to make a mad dash across the Azara and the Kohen accidentally walking steps on it. Now he's touching a dead sharet. The Kohen is tummy. He's got to leave immediately. He's got to go out the shortest route. Right? To go, just to get his briefcase from the other side of the Azara. That would violate, he would then be in violation of having desecrated the mikdash. If he goes out the straightest route, he has done nothing wrong. He's not liable for any kind of punishment, the mazid, the shogeg, and so on. He just goes out the best way. So it's not the same prohibition, but it seems to be a similar idea. The starting point of the discussion in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Avelos, where the laws of Tumas Kohanim are found, is that the Kohen has to leave immediately. So the Ramah, what they say is the following. The Ramah says that, and the Achronim say, some of the Achronim say, it's only when the Tumah is Doraisa, not when the Tumah is the Rabbanah. The Ramah says, I believe this is already his formulation, is that a Kohen has to leave immediately. And if the Kohen, if you know that the Tumah is there, but the Kohen doesn't know, then the right thing to do is to wake the Kohen and ask him to come outside. but don't tell him why you're asking. So if you ask him to come outside, he has no idea that there is tumah inside the house. So let's go outside. He's going to put on his bathrobe. He'll come outside. You say, okay, good. You're out of here. You can't go back in because there's a mason in the house. But if somehow the Kohen discovered, the Rama says he's got to run out. It's like it's a fire. Okay. The Dago Merivava, which is a small little commentary on the Shulchan Aruch by one of the major luminaries, the Nozib Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau Fran. Most people have probably heard of the Nozib Yehuda, the Chuvos Nozib Yehuda, probably maybe the single most important work of Chuvos in the period of the Achronim. He has a small commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch called the Dago Merivava. And in the Dago Merivava, he writes here, he thinks that the Rama is wrong. He thinks that even if the Kohen found out that there was a base in the bias, and that he was in the house, somebody dies, and somebody died, you need to leave. So the Dago Merivava thinks that the Kohen can stop and put on his garment. And he makes a very, very brief reference. He doesn't explain, but it's a sort of a famous issue, which he says that he believes that there are two reasons or two paths for those reasons why a Kohen is allowed to take the time to go out. He does have to go out, at least neither Rabbanan probably, but he can take the time to put on his clothes. Number one is that there is a machlokas. Well, there may be a machlokas. This is a famous source of controversy. There is a machlokas whether or not a Kohen who is tameh violates anything further by being tameh again. Now, I can give you the following scenario. If a Kohen is right now carrying the mace that he's allowed to be carrying, let's say it's his relative, his father, his mother, is carrying the aron, so he's in contact with someone now, it would be very clear that touching another mace at the same time, I think we all agree, you don't get malchus for doing so. As long as he's engaged and in contact with this tuma that he's touching, so there's no further iser in touching other tuma. It's only once the Kohen separates from the tuma, he steps out, they put the mace in the ground, he steps out. Now for him to touch another mace while he's tameh, but he's already been poresh, so that the Rambam says, is Oscar. I think the Kohen gets malchus for that. But but as long as he's not poresh ben hameh, so there's no additional violation. That's the way it is suggested. And so the Dago Merivava thinks that as long as the Kohen is in the bias, he's as long as he's in contact with that same tuma, he's not doing anything worse when he's there a little bit longer. He has to leave. That may be the Rabbanan. He's got to separate from the tuma eventually.
He's not
violating another issa by remaining. So that's not okay. That's not of great significance to us. But there's a much bigger issue, which the Ravid raises. The Ravid claims they think not clear what the Ravid means. The Ravid says that a Kohen who's tameh mace, and now becomes tameh again does not get malchus. Because manazet, that's the Ravid. So Hanum Artsmeim is manazet all of them pretty much. They don't get malchus. There's no malchus for touching it again. Now, the controversy that arose is that there are some who understood the Ravid, including the Nozib Yehuda himself originally. He later changed his mind about this, understood that the Ravid's position is that this manazan, I don't know if it's only this manazan, but Kohen is tameh, there's no further issue becoming tameh. Now that has huge ramifications. We don't accept this Ravid, certainly not on its own. But the huge ramifications of something that would be a Kohen going to medical school. And a Kohen, I don't know what people in my community, also it's very rare that you know, might have one or two people at Kohanim gone to medical school. I'm not sure how they went to medical school. Today it might be easier, actually. Today they use cadavers less and less. It might be more possible to do so. But 30, 40 years ago, it was virtually bordered on the impossible for a Kohen to go to medical school without running into violations of, you know, Chilu Kedushas Kahuna. But if you held like the Ravid, well, once a Kohen is tameh, most Kohanim become tameh. In fact, almost all Kohanim are tameh on something we'll talk about. We're not going to have time to talk about today, but talk about it in the next year. So then there's no further issue of a Kohen being tameh, in which case once the Kohen is tameh, it won't be a problem going to medical school. Now, none of the classic poskim accept the Ravid. Many say, and they know that he's changed his mind about this. I'll tell you where originally he wanted to use the Ravid. But many say the writer doesn't say that it's mutter. He just says you don't get malchus. It could even be osur min haTorah for a kohen that's not hazeh, who's tameh, to become tameh again. It's just that once he's tameh, there's no malchus for becoming tameh again, even though there is a prohibition. So what the Ravid actually said is a really, really interesting question. Most of the Acharonim, I think, settle on this idea. They're not willing to assume that the Ravid actually said it was mutter, but just that the Ravid said there's no punishment, there's no malchus. I have to dig it out. There used to be a writing contest at YU. It was called the Imre Sheffer Contest. I was the director of the contest for its existence, about 20 years. And the best paper that was ever written for that contest, I'm trying to remember who the other one. The author was Rabbi Yaakov Jaffe, who's like the I think Torah Studies principal, something Maimonides in Boston, and one of the Rabbi Shabtai, Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai, who wrote a book in the last years about brain death, a really comprehensive work about the halachos around this and the shitos and so on. So they wrote an article for this contest in which they actually explored the Ravid's Shita. And what was interesting was not the explanation of Ravid's Shita, but how two different printings of the Shas, where the Ravid in the back on the wrist, there's Ravid on the wrist, where it was printed in two different editions would have determined how you understood the Ravid and what was he commenting on. And their argument, I think, was actually, it wasn't for halachic purposes per se, was that the Acharonim who backed away had the Ravid in the wrong place. And that's the way they read it, as opposed to for another place. If someone nudges me, I'll try to dig out the paper. It was really unbelievable. But regardless of what the Ravid actually meant, so most Acharonim assumed that the Ravid did not actually say that it's mutter. He just said that there's no onesh. But an example where the Noda Behuda once originally had wanted to use the Ravid and then kind of backed away was with the following. And this could have relevance to a medical school question also, if you knew that all the cadavers weren't Jewish and you didn't have to touch them, which is there is a machlokas harishonim, whether a non-Jewish mace is mitame. Now, there is a very fringe shita that claims that a non-Jewish mace doesn't convey any tuma. That position is not accepted. That's not even quoted in Shulchan Aruch. The two main positions that a mace who's a non-Jew is either that he's mitame only b'maga u'b'masa, by physical contact or by supporting its weight, carrying it if you're not touching, but not in an ohel. I mean, a goy in an ohel is not a problem. And that's the Rambam's pshat. And the Balei HaTosfos paskin now that a goy who's a mace is mitame just like a Jew. It's two opinions in the Gemara. And so Machlokas had a paskin. So if you assume, so there are a lot of Rishonim, there's a strong basis for the Rambam's position. And again, this produces enormous ramifications, halach lamaisa for Kohanim, that if you were to hold that a non-Jew is not matame, but ohel, that makes life a lot easier in many contexts for Kohanim. For example, going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where do they have the mummies? Mm-hmm. Right? So if a mace is matame, if a mace akum is matame, but ohel, then a Kohen is not allowed to go into the Met. Whereas if it's not Metame Ba'ohel, so then it would be permissible for the Kohen to do so. We are Machmir. Kohanim are not supposed to go into the Met. But the Noda Behuda wanted to combine possibly two shitos, the Kula of following the Rambam's opinion, that a mace is not, he wasn't about the Metropolitan Museum of Art, whatever his context was. Number one is that a mace akum, a mace is a guy, he doesn't commit coming in Ohel. And if the Kohanim are Tameh already, then according to the Ravid, the way he originally read it, there's no prohibition of doing so. Later he kind of back, I don't remember what the context of the tshuva was, what was the specific issue that he was dealing with, but he eventually backed away from that. But in the Dago Mervava here, he's this is still the earlier stage. So he says that according to the Ravid, once the Kohen is Tameh in the house, he has to leave, but he doesn't have to embarrass himself because there's no issue of Darais anymore of the Kohen being there. So the Dago Mervava, even without the Ravid, he thought that the Ramah was incorrect, that even if the Kohen himself knew that there was a mace in the house, he was unclothed, he doesn't have to run out before he puts on his clothing. But of course, the proper thing to do would be not to tell the Kohen in the first place, but rather to ask him to come out of the house and then explain to him why you asked him to come out of the house, at which point he will be clothed.
Yeah. In the beginning here, this is what we started with. Keylining every moment that you're wearing it is you're over.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't say where the source of that is, and if that source exists
So the only reason why it might not exist with Tuma is because what, if you think about it, when you take off the Kelayim, you're no longer in violation of anything, right? It's gone. Mm-hmm. When you step out of the bias of the Tuma, you're still Tuma. Right? That's why the Kohen may not get Malkus, or maybe not violate the rice up. He's still carrying his mace and he touches another mace at the same time. Right, because that's a more extreme view. That's not the right, but I'm in contact with the tuma that I'm allowed to be. So I am in a state of tuma that you cannot change right now. And therefore there's no issur of further tuma. At least for the Rambam, let's say, until I leave the cemetery, I'm not touching my mace. Now I could potentially violate it again. But the assumption is that tuma, because the tuma lingers in whichever shita you're looking at, because the tuma lingers, you are not it's not a continuous violation. You violated it, and now you won't get a next punishment until you step out and then come back. Whereas by Kelayim, there's no basis for assuming that, you know, I would say the following. Kelayim, from a conceptual perspective, although you have to prove it, the prohibition of Kelayim is not so much putting Kelayim on. It's deriving Hana from wearing the Kelayim. You know, it's what we call Hana Aschimum. And so that you continue to gain, you continue to derive that Hana as long as you're wearing it. Okay. So I'm not going to go further here. I'll take it if there are any questions. But the Gemara now has set up this idea that Kavod HaBrios is not Zocha Kelayim. And therefore, even though it would be humiliating to the person who discovered the Kelayim, you still have to step out. You still have to strip the clothing down and the shuk, you know, then you'll run home. I'm not saying this to mitigate the Gemara's effects, because I'm not sure the halacha would be different, but in all probability, when someone stripped off their malbush of kelayim, they were probably wearing their underwear underneath. They were probably not totally unclothed, just because if you look at the way the Gemara typically describes the clothing they wore, but still you can understand why someone doesn't want to walk out, you know, in public in their underwear. But I'm not sure the halacha would be different if they weren't, but I suspect that the matzias that the Gemara is talking about is. Okay, any questions?
Thank you.
Okay.